Dr. G. Hirsch is the Executive Director of the MIT Center for Biomedical Innovation, or CBI. As part of her mission to innovate the drug development process, Dr. Hirsch will serve as co-chair of the DIA 2016 annual meeting in Philadelphia, where she will also participate in a panel discussion on Europe and the U.S., making outcomes-based healthcare possible. I am Alberto Grignolo, deputy editor for DIA's Global Forum. I am grateful for this opportunity to discuss with Dr. Hirsch the purpose and prospects of the MIT CBI and the DIA annual meeting. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Hirsch, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Alberto. I appreciate it.
Let me get to the first question right away. The MIT CBI mission statement says, quote, focuses on improving global health by overcoming challenges to the development, diffusion, and adoption of biomedical innovations, end of quote. How similar to or different from is this work compared to the activities of the NIH National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS? In fact, are there any synergies or complementarities between these two organizations?
That's a great question. First, let me just say that I know NCATS is doing a lot of terrific stuff, and so much so that it's hard, I have trouble keeping up with it all. So I probably don't have the most up-to-date information, and similarly, at the Center for Biomedical Innovation, we also have a lot of activities going on as well. What I'm going to do in this discussion with you today is to focus primarily on one of the major activity areas within CBI, which is our New DIGS Consortium, stands for the New Drug Development Paradigms Consortium, which I run. Now, in New DIGS and NCATS actually have some central themes in common. Probably most importantly, we're both focused on accelerating the delivery of new, better treatments to patients. So we both have very patient-centered missions. And absolutely, there's a lot of complementarity, which I can highlight in a moment. And we are actually in the process now of exploring some potential ways to work together. So that was a terrifically timely question. And I was just reading a recent interview with Chris Austin, who runs NCATS, and there's a new major initiative they have underway that is looking at revolutionizing the way they study disease and discover treatment. So I think in general, my understanding of NCATS is they tend to focus a bit more on what I call the left-hand side of the value chain, more on the pre-market side of things. And in New DIGS, I think our mission in New DIGS is to deliver new, better, affordable treatments to the right patients faster, and to do that reliably and sustainably. So we're trying to innovate across the entire value chain, and in particular, we spend a lot of our time looking at ways of bridging pre-market and post-market. At the core of what we're doing, I think we share a belief in our collaborator community that in many ways, interestingly, the science is advancing faster than the system is. And by system, what I mean are the processes, the infrastructures, the policies that basically form the path from the bench out to the patients. The system is evolving, it will evolve, but as it does in this industry, it's slow, it's siloed, it's fragmented, it's inefficient, the way that we go about changing. And as a result of that, in the meantime, there are existing treatments that can't be accessed by patients. There are new treatments that are coming, but slower than they might. What we try to do in New DIGS is to focus on ways of accelerating the coordinated evolution of that system in ways that coordinate across the downstream world of regulators, payers, patients, and providers, and coordinate that evolution with what's happening from the world of science. And we believe that by working together across stakeholders in some fundamentally new ways and using systems engineering concepts and methods to structure these collaborations, that we can actually accelerate the evolution of the system in ways that drive greater value to patients, but in ways that also work for the other stakeholders, which is critical if it's going to be sustainable. So at the end of the day, New DIGS is a systems engineering consortium. It's global in focus. It involves all of the stakeholders across the value chain. And I can give three specific examples of things that we're doing that highlight how we work and what we're trying to do.
Yes,
first, let me
just
pause. See if you have any questions, if that makes sense, before I jump into the three examples.
It makes perfect sense. I was really going to get to a question of how do you do this. It sounds like CBI is a convener of the various stakeholders and an entity, a clearinghouse perhaps, where the various voices are heard and the debates are catalyzed, if you will. Would that be an accurate description of what you do?
Yes, I think that that's true. I think as one of the faculty members I work with says, I get it that we can't keep working in our silos any longer, but the question is, and I could get anybody you want into a room, but I'm not quite sure what to do with them once they're there. And so the actual mechanisms by which productive collaborations happen with such a diverse team of collaborators, that in and of itself is quite a challenge and a core competency that I think as an ecosystem we need to cultivate, and it's a big part of what we do in New Digs. So the three examples I can give you that can hopefully make this sound a little bit less vague, one of the kinds of things that we do in New Digs is that we design new solutions. For example, we have a project that we're in the process of launching right now, which is focused on creating new financing and reimbursement models for curative therapies in the United States. So the challenge here is actually a very good challenge to have. The science has taken us to a point where there actually are cures that are beginning to come through the pipeline, but it's not clear how we're going to pay for those. And how we solve that dilemma is very important. We need to price them for value. We need to make sure that the manufacturers have adequate incentives to continue innovating, but at the same time, they need to be affordable. Both now, patients need to be able to access these things that they've been waiting for so long to treat their diseases. They need access to them, and also over the long haul, they have to be affordable for the system. So we have a project going on now working with investors, payers, companies, patients, providers, and academia, developing concepts for new financing and reimbursement models that we will do concept design, prototyping, rigorous evaluation and refinement, and de-risk them before they move into actual real-world pilot projects. We work with the MIT Sloan School of Management and their Laboratory for Financial Engineering, among others, in that work. So that's one example where we're actually designing new solutions with the input of multiple stakeholders.
Just very quickly, sponsors have sometimes argued that drugs can be expensive because developing them is so expensive. Do you believe that the cost of developing a new medicine belongs in a conversation around the affordability of the new medicines for patients and around the ecosystem that you have described in this initiative?
I do think so. I think I don't think that that gives the entire story, but certainly the cost of R&D and the cost of failed R&D efforts does need to be taken into consideration in this. But that's just one of the considerations. So I think we are just embarking on this now and looking at multiple inputs on how to balance and align the various needs of different stakeholders in that process.
Thank you. And you have two more examples, you said?
Yes. The next example would be we're involved in process innovation as well. And an example that I would give you on that one is one that actually might surprise people a bit. It is the work that we've done that a number of folks are probably aware of in under the umbrella of adaptive licensing. And I say that people might be surprised by that because many people think that that's about policy innovation, when in fact adaptive licensing is actually, I think, much more about process innovation than it is about policy innovation. The challenge that we were trying to tackle when we first took on adaptive licensing was the question of how we move from binary go-no-go decision making, primarily for regulators, but also for other stakeholders as well. How do we move from binary go-no-go decision-making to more progressive reduction of uncertainty, where we optimize the management of benefit and risk and value of uncertainty for patients as we move forward. This is particularly important, I think, as we move into a world where we can stratify by subpopulations of patients who have different benefit risk profiles. So accessing these products might begin to look quite different than it has historically with a more of a one-size-fits-all model. So I won't go into the details of what we did in our adaptive licensing project other than to say we developed a case-based modeling and simulation methodology, our scenario design methodology, that we applied to 13 different proprietary products to develop use cases where all the stakeholders were at the table and helped together. We thought through different ways of applying some of the emerging principles of this adaptive licensing model. And based on that portfolio of 13 use cases, I believe that our work helped to inspire the pilot program on adaptive pathways, which is now unfolding across Europe. And also, it, I think, provided some inspiration to the launching of the Innovative Medicines Initiative's ADAPT Smart Consortium, which is also focused on adaptive pathways and enabling that. So that was an example of process innovation involving all the stakeholders. And I'll just mention too, I'll just throw this in, that the power of this model of adaptive licensing became more and more apparent to us as we did our work, not just for decision making relating to regulators, but to the entire ecosystem of players. And we've now expanded this model to a broader tent, if you will, under the name of adaptive biomedical innovation. And there will be a special themed issue of Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics coming out later this year with the entire issue focused on adaptive biomedical innovation.
Very interesting. This reminds me that some people have referred to what is known as a magic moment before which a drug is not approved and after which it is suddenly approved. Are we moving away from the concept of that magic moment through the adaptive licensing framework and construct?
Yes, I think that's a really great way to put it. It's much more about adaptive decision making, recognizing that there needs to be a more progressive reduction of uncertainty, and that all stakeholders are making decisions under uncertainty, and the goal is to do the best that you can at the moment, but have a clear and explicit plan for continuing to reduce uncertainties through ongoing evidence generation, with a plan to incorporate that through feedback and modify and refine the access to conditions for patients to these new products.
You had a third example, I believe.
Yes, the third example is a bit different, and that is we focus a fair amount on not only innovating things ourselves in new digs, but recognizing that there are many, many important innovations that are being developed by other initiatives, other groups. And oftentimes the challenge is not just about the innovation process itself, but figuring out how to take these new innovations and actually begin using them. How do we use them? Given the complexity of biomedical innovation and healthcare itself, how do we take some of these new innovations and use them? The concrete example of this in that category that we're involved in is our data program. And the central question there is trying to understand how do we begin moving from what I think of as big data hype, that is a lot of excitement and legitimate excitement about all the different kinds of big data that's available, and in particular real-world data that's now available from electronic health records, claims data, registries, mobile apps, etc. How do we take that data and use it in ways that actually improve decision-making and drive meaningful value to patients? How do we do this in a highly regulated industry in the absence of evidence standards for real-world evidence? So we have a project that is focused on that, and it employs the use of our scenario design methodology and continuous iterative planning of evidence generation that combines randomized controlled clinical trials with real-world evidence, and looks at ways that, as an ecosystem, we can begin to leverage the what I think of as latent value that exists within the rapidly evolving big data infrastructure, such as the Sentinel Initiative, PCORnet, mobile applications, methodologies that are coming out of initiatives like the former OMOP, now called Odyssey. How do we begin to bring all those together into an integrated application environment and, as an ecosystem, apply them in the context of actual cases, real products that are in the pipeline today? So that is my third example. I think that the power of a multi-stakeholder collaboration to help us figure out how to drive meaningful value through the diffusion and adoption of new innovations into practice and policy.
It's very exciting. You mentioned that you're able to get all the stakeholders in the room, but you're not certain what to do with them when they're in. But it sounds to me that you do very well know how to leverage all the minds and interests and their perspectives. Yeah?
Well, I will say that our methodologies are continuing to evolve, and I find that a particularly exciting to see how to do. We operate within a safe haven environment. MIT CBI serves as a neutral intermediary wherever there may be potential issues around competition and potential conflicts of interest. And there's a lot of stakeholder management given the global distributed community we have across multiple stakeholder silos, different organizations, et cetera. We do, as I said before, use systems engineering approaches, very case-based. We use actual individual products as lenses through which engaged to view the system and understand what does and doesn't work from each stakeholder's perspective. We use a lot of modeling and simulation, both qualitative and quantitative, and do a lot of concept prototyping, refinement, and de-risking. When it comes to the time for pilots, most likely they won't happen within new digs, but through implementation partnerships. So that's also a bit different from how NCATS operates, because I think they actually do implementation and scaling within the NCATS platform itself.
I'd like to ask you another question. Back in 2010, FDA CDER director Dr. Janet Woodcock identified the separation between clinical research and clinical practice as one of the most serious problems with the clinical research enterprise. Do you think this is still true? Does your work at CBI address this separation? And if so, how do you do it?
Yes, I couldn't agree more with that. I think increasingly it's going to be critical that we begin to see that there's a seamless continuum of knowledge from pre-market to post-market. It has to become more and more seamless, and the divide between clinical research and clinical practice is a great divide still to this moment. There are many aspects to that challenge, to bridging that gap: legal, ethical, technical, policy. The area that we work on really maps back to one of the examples that I just gave, and how we use real-world evidence in practice, integrating it with randomized controlled clinical trials to address some of the uncertainties that RCTs alone cannot address adequately. And so I would say that while there are major infrastructures that are being built, such as one that NCATS is developing now and the big data infrastructures I mentioned before, what we focus on is actually more of a bottom-up approach, is to say that as some of these capabilities are evolving, how do we actually use them? How do we put them into use? And we are developing some frameworks that can help us to work together as a diverse multi-stakeholder group as we move forward in these use cases. And again, in the absence of evidence standards like GCP that exist for randomized controlled clinical trials, we don't have something like that to guide our use yet with real-world evidence. So we're trying to figure out how to both inform the evolution of some of those policies and at the same time drive real, tangible value for patients in the near term as well. Some of our work is now beginning to move from use cases into thinking about efficacy to effectiveness strategies and study designs, ETE study designs. We hope to be piloting some of these in the next year or two, and also begin looking at how to apply some of these principles around E2E strategies to enrich some of the emerging basket and umbrella trial platforms that are evolving that are so exciting in the industry today.
From what you've observed so far, real-world evidence, of course, it's enormous and has a lot of noise in it by definition. What horizon do you envision in terms of really using real-world evidence in productive ways, useful ways, maybe eliminating some of the noise or accepting that noise is part of life and is part of real-world evidence that cannot be fully eliminated? What's the horizon? When can we really look to leverage real-world evidence in real concrete ways?
Well, I think we have to crawl before we walk on this. I think use cases actually turn out to be very, very critical. We find these to be extremely useful exercises. I think we all learn a lot with each product that we evaluate. I think that we will probably begin to move from use cases, and I know there are a number of these underway across the industry, to begin to identify patterns and guidances that would then evolve ultimately into some forms of standards. But I think what's striking to me from our work is how incredibly context-specific the principles around the use of real-world evidence actually are. So the opportunity to look at a diverse portfolio of products and use cases is extraordinarily helpful to begin getting our head around some of the patterns of use. And I think also I hope that we can begin to develop an open access knowledge management repository that can help all of us learn and move forward together from these use cases.
I have a question about patient engagement. Innovation often describes technological or scientific progress, but could you explain how the CBI New Digs initiative is driving innovation in engaging patients in the development of new drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all in New Dig certainly see not just patient engagement, but actual patient empowerment to be one of the great game changers in biomedical innovation today that's on the horizon. Great stuff already happening. The way that we actually are trying to harness this power is we are engaging patients in our scenario design sessions. And the particular area that I think is going to be an interesting one for us is that as we continue to evolve our processes and tools for modeling and simulation of these multi-stakeholder planning exercises, we're very interested in beginning to develop some visualization tools that could make meaningful patient participation in decision-making about benefit, risk, value kinds of trade-offs. We could help them to engage in more meaningful ways. Visualization tools could help to level the playing field and help to create more intuitive capabilities for real-time synthesis and participation in decision-making for patients. And we're beginning to work with folks from the world of decision science, patient preferences, and even interactive gaming technologies in an effort to help level the playing field for patients to participate in decision-making with some who have more technical backgrounds.
How do you select which patients will represent the patient voice for any particular disease, if you will? Is it the head of a patient advocacy organization? Is any patient at random? How do you select, how do you know who represents the patient voice in the best way?
That's a brilliant question, and it has been a steep learning curve for us in New Digs how to go about doing that. Moving from general policy innovation, where we were not at all clear on who to engage for the patient voice, but I think in the world of this disease-specific discussions that we have, we're building relationships with groups and individuals that we trust. But it's, you know, we're on a steep learning curve, and I'm not sure that I have the ultimate answer on that. We're continuing to learn as we go. But making sure you do have the right patients in the room for substantive engagement is absolutely critical to success on these exercises.
So you haven't quite figured it out, but you are working on it. Very diligent.
It's a high priority, and we're getting better as we go.
Understood. In the few minutes remaining, Dr. Hirsch, I'd like to ask you, what intrigued you the most about serving as DIA 2016 annual meeting co-chair, and why did you accept this responsibility?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this opportunity because I think that we're currently at an inflection point in this industry that's largely being driven by some of the exciting breakthroughs in science. I think we're seeing now, and we're going to continue to see, an unprecedented degree of innovation, not just in the science, but in the system that supports the science to ensure that patients derive meaningful and timely value from the emerging science. So massive amounts of innovation going on at the level of the system, and historically, as I said, we're kind of slow and fragmented in how we do that, and also these innovations in systems tend to happen locally, whereas diseases and companies are global. So I think we have an urgent imperative now to learn quickly how, wherever possible, we can align and coordinate and synergize across traditional silos to drive real-time harmonization of innovation. And this is also across geographic silos. So I think that the patients are waiting for us. We've got to figure out how to do this better and faster and more efficiently. And the DIA provides an incredibly powerful platform for engaging globally around some of these important innovations that are happening in real time and need to continue to evolve. So I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to interact with folks there this month.
Your annual meeting co-chair, Dr. Hans-Georg Eichler of EMA, has described the DIA annual meeting as a, quote, market of ideas, unquote. Would you agree with his assessment?
I would, and I always love the way that Hans-Georg Eichler comes up with these simple sound bites for complex concepts. That's a great description of it.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing you at the next Market of Ideas, the DIA annual meeting later in June. And thank you very much, Dr. Hirsch, for sharing your time and insights today and for all of your work on behalf of the global healthcare community.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.